Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
The group that I interviewed in central Missouri called Sand Hill Farm, when they finally realized that actually what they were doing was not farming, that they were just growing good soil, their farming practices became actually a lot more successful.
Daniel Tucker learned a lot about how small farmers do what they do through the process of writing his book, Farm Together Now. Harvest Public Media speculates why there aren't more young farmers. Later in the program, a game is helping the young farmers we do have learn how to play the markets. Wild rice in endive boats, Chef Daniel Orr's recipe for the day. And we're excited to start talking maple syrup and maybe encourage you to tap some trees on your property. Obesity rates for the very young are on the decline. Food marketing in schools could get a facelift. But first, Luann Johnson gives us an update on the drought in California.
The federal government announced this week that it would not be providing irrigation from any of the state's rivers, canals, or reservoirs, including major water projects. Farmers will not receive water from the Central Valley Project or, for the first time in 54 years, from the State Water Project. The current drought in California is one of the worst in recorded history. Though farmers have been trying to cope with the water shortage, the news still comes as a blow. Some crops, like watermelon, lettuce, and cantaloupe, aren't being planted, and farmers who raise meat are seeing their livestock dwindle. The ripple effect is about to hit grocery stores, where a $40 shopping trip is expected to go up as much as 15%. Growing your own vegetables is an option. Home gardens take less water than large commercial endeavors. The San Francisco Gate has tips for the home gardener, including fixing leaks, choosing good soil, and planting in February and early March to take advantage of any rainfall that may come. Find a link to those gardening tips at eartheats.org. Rain did fall in California this week, but there's a downside. With up to 6 inches of rain expected in certain areas, that can mean flash flooding and mudslides. Good news for children's health, both current and future. There was a 43% drop in obesity rates for children aged 2 to 5 over the past decade. Researchers were encouraged by what is seen as potentially a shift in American health, as obesity often sets in for young children by the age of 5. The study didn't look into reasons for the decline, but several theories support the facts. One reason could be federal programs aimed at creating and reinforcing healthier habits. While state policies, like New York's banning of trans fats, have helped to remove unhealthy additives from food, food companies have also limited their marketing to children, with food ads aimed at this particular age group dropping 13.7% from 2003 to 2007. And speaking of food ads aimed at kids, overhauling school lunch was the first step to making schools healthier for children. Soon, schools will also be an unhealthy marketing-free zone. First Lady Michelle Obama, together with Secretary of State Tom Vilsack, announced new school wellness guidelines that would ensure marketing to children at schools would not conflict with the healthier lunches and snacks provided. As part of the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act of 2010, sugary, salty, fatty foods, formerly on lunch trays and available in vending machines, have been replaced with more fruit, vegetables, and whole grains. Proposed rules would ban cups, posters, and menu boards from advertising food that doesn't meet standards, like Coca-Cola or McDonald's. After-school activities would not be affected. Schools have some agency in the decision-making process. For events like fundraisers at fast food restaurants outside of school, marketing that event would need to be done plainly and to the adults. Schools are also allowed to weigh in on incentives like Pizza Hut's Book It program, where children are given vouchers for pizza in exchange for reading. Thanks to Liz Leslie for these stories. Read more at eartheats.org.
Hop on Twitter to get food news from us 24/7. Connect with @EarthEats. Our headlines from Luann Johnson.
Thanks, Annie.
The Census of Agriculture studies who's farming the land. It's released every 5 years, and for the last few decades, it's shown that farmers have been getting older. The latest census shows a slight uptick in the number of young farmers, but not enough to stop the average age of American farmers from climbing. As Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports, many worry that rural communities are at risk without new blood.
Eric Brockman lives on a sleepy, snow-covered street in the small town of West Point in northeast Nebraska, his hometown. As he sits on the living room sofa, his two-year-old daughter, Olivia, stands behind him with a comb, working on his hairdo.
You have this hair right back here.
It's Monday, and Brockman would love to be out feeding the pigs or fixing a tractor. But today, he has the day off from his job managing an ethanol plant. It's an hour and a half away in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Brockman says running the ethanol plant is a good job, but it's not exactly the career he wanted.
Don't get me wrong, I love what I'm doing right now, but what I've always wanted to do is farm, be in the dirt all the time.
Brockman grew up on the farm. His parents feed hogs and farm 2,000 acres of corn and soybeans outside of West Point. He still helps out around planting and harvest, but he won't be taking over the family business. His dad is just in his 40s, and his brother wants to farm too.
There isn't a whole lot of farm ground to spread out amongst, three people. It makes it pretty difficult, and to find your own ground is pretty hard.
That trouble connecting new farmers with the land they need is happening across the country, and it shows when you look at farm demographics. The average farmer was 50 years old in 1978. Preliminary results from the 2012 Ag Census show it's closer to 58 now. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack says that's up from the previous census.
It's increased by over a year, and that continues a trend that has occurred over the course of the last 20 to 30 years.
But Vilsack says there are signs of progress.
If you look at young farmers in two categories, those under 25 and those under 35, we've seen actually slight increases. But we need to accelerate that level of increase.
Farmers under 35 years old only grew by about 1% nationally. Dave Baker helps families pass down their farms at Iowa State University's Beginning Farmer Center. He says the concern isn't that the country will run out of farmers. It's that small towns are losing people. They need young families to regenerate businesses and institutions built by previous generations.
And so I look at small rural communities and churches and schools and say, if you're not creating opportunities for young people to join you in your area, you're a terminal community.
To stay viable, Baker says rural towns need more people like Eric Brockman. Brockman lived in Omaha with his wife and five kids before moving to West Point 6 months ago. He wants to get on the local school board, and he says he's committed to finding a farm, as long as it may take.
Keep your name out there, keep calling, keep asking around, and if you want to eventually get some ground, you have to be persistent. Because there's more people out there that are looking for the same thing.
If rural communities want to stay strong, they'll need more beginners to find their way onto the farm. Brockman and other prospective farmers are ready to get their hands dirty. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Coming up at the end of the program, another Harvest report about an online game that teaches farmers how to be better marketers. When Daniel Tucker and his fellow authors were brainstorming for the book Farm Together Now, they realized that they weren't capable of contributing to the conversation analyzing the problems with the food system. So instead, they focused on meeting people all over the country who are experimenting with solutions for the broken food system. What they came up with is a series of farmer profiles, from urban farms addressing the issues of food deserts to small rural farms that are trying to rebuild healthy soil.
And that was really our kind of primary concern in selecting people, was thinking about how to represent kind of the widest range of people that are engaging in kind of food-related activism today.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the people. One guy, David Myers of On the Fly Farms in Michigan. There's a graphic in the book that has a list of the expenses and then the list of income. And it matches up. It's equal. So no profit for this farm whatsoever. Did you find that a lot of farmers were operating with that sort of budget sheet?
David was unique in that he calculated in his farm business ledger a cost that most people don't account for, and that is really what drew us to David, and that is a solidarity subsidy.
Yeah. What?
And what he means by that is that he's going to ask urban people that he knows in the Chicago area. He's a farmer in southwestern Michigan, just right around the bend of Lake Michigan. And he sort of insists or requires that the people that buy his food pay a little extra. so that he can give a certain percentage of it away in low-income communities throughout the city, and that they were sort of using food as a tool to basically engage people around a whole host of issues.
Well, I'm curious to talk a little bit more about the concept of the solidarity fund, where people give a little bit more so that other people can have healthy foods. So this seems to be working on a very small scale for this one guy's farm. Can this work on a large scale? Could this be a large-scale solution for our country's food system problems?
I don't think that that model is going to scale up very big. That's true. And that's an important thing to recognize, is a lot of these experiments, they work quite well and they're quite admirable and inspiring on a small scale. And as you start to scale them up, you know, the contradictions start to show through more, or the complexity starts to show through more. But that stuff's always there, and it just is, you know, a little easier to work around on a small scale. And so I think that some of the models that are introduced in the book can be scaled up. But in particular, I would say the people who are organizing themselves as cooperatives. There's a long history of agricultural and food-related cooperative businesses in the U.S., and that's something that we can draw from. And the cooperative structure allows for a kind of subtle but meaningful shift in the way that the economics of food or any business work.
When you're creating an urban farm, you obviously have to think about what plot of land you're going to take to create a farm out of. Soil is a living thing, and if you leave it alone for a really long time, you know, it might not necessarily be the best soil or best plot of land for growing food. Talk about some people that you spoke with that had to repurpose soil in the city, or that had a hard time figuring out how to grow food in a certain spot.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think it's a big challenge in urban areas and also in rural areas, because people have grown the same plants and vegetables on rural farmland for way too long and have not cared for their soil, and it's a big problem everywhere. And the group that I interviewed in central Missouri called Sand Hill Farm, when they first got started, they made a lot of mistakes. But then when they finally realized that actually what they were doing was not farming, that they were just growing good soil, good healthy soil, and they kind of shifted their mentality to put the emphasis on the soil and not necessarily on the bounty, that their farming practices became actually a lot more successful.
In 10 years, where do you see the farming system in this country?
I think in 10 years, there is a real chance that we have right now, if we take advantage of this moment, that we're going to be eating a lot more food that is produced nearby us. And I think that that's going to happen sort of for two reasons. The sort of more negative reason is because I think it's just going to have to happen because food prices are soaring across the world, and the kind of logic that we use to organize how we ship grain and vegetables across oceans, is that's not going to be able to last forever. And then the more hopeful reason is because I think people are recognizing the real joy in relating to food, each other, land in a different way that's kind of been forgotten. And I think that people are doing a great job of experimenting with solutions to those kind of challenges right now. And what I am hopeful for in order to get to a better place in 10 years is that people will start to put their heads together a little bit more and think about kind of some shared principles and values that we can sort of push forward with together.
Cool. Daniel Tucker, thanks so much for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Read the complete interview with Daniel Tucker on our website, eartheats.org. Here's a handheld hors d'oeuvres recipe with wild rice, pears, and pecans. Now, you might not have pears on hand this time of year, but you could have apples. You are always encouraged to make substitutions on our recipes to fit what you have in your fridge. First, Chef Daniel Orr drops some knowledge. Wild rice is not actually a grain.
It's actually a grass. It's a water grass. It's a long thin, dark, black to brown seed. Again, it's a good idea always to wash any of your grains. And then what you do is you just put it with some water and boil it until it blooms, okay? So when it blooms, all the seed pods open up and kind of split. They actually look like kind of like little canoes. And what I do is when I boil my rice, I add a little bit of chopped onions, salt and pepper, a little bit of olive oil, and that's it. And we're just going to do a fun little salad with this. This is the perfect thing to make when you're having some friends come over to have some cocktails. This is the perfect thing to serve in little barquettes of endive. So, you know the Belgian endive, which are the yellow things? You cut off the base, and you can open them up and make little boats out of them. And you've got a great little past hors d'oeuvre that's healthy and fresh. The nuttiness of the rice really goes well with other nuts. So you could use some pecans, which I'm using. They've been lightly toasted. I'm just going to chop them up so they're about the same size as the rice. Okay, and to that I'm going to add a couple slices of red Anjou pear, which will give it a nice color. This is also going to have a little sweetness to it and a little crunch. Okay, to this you can add whatever kind of herbs you like. Chopped basil, chopped chervil, chopped cilantro, whatever you like, you can add to it. You know, at Earth Eats, we're pretty loose here, you know. We give you ideas, and you go out there and make them your own, and then you don't even have to give us credit. And with any salad, you need a little bit of acid. So today I'm going to use some orange juice because I want to play off that sweetness of the pears. Okay, I'm just going to stir that up well. Give her a little taste test. I think it's pretty good.
This recipe, along with a vegan and gluten-free sausage and black-eyed pea hash. Wow. EarthEats.org. Coming up, making your own maple syrup starts with identifying the right trees.
And what we're looking at when we're tapping a tree is we want to start out with a minimum of 10 inches in diameter. If you go below that size, the tree isn't mature enough to be able to kind of handle that damage from year to year.
And go above that size and your tap won't reach the good stuff. Michael Bell talks us through tapping maple trees, and we chat with Michael Farrell, author of The Sugar Maker's Companion. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Bloomington Hypnosis, with certified hypnotist and self-hypnosis instructor John Hunkler, helping clients relax into weight loss for health and fitness. Bloomington Hypnosis, 812-200-5005. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Today is a beautiful day for tapping maple trees at the Hinkle Garden Farmstead in Bloomington, Indiana.
They were sitting on the table.
Okay.
Exactly. Thanks. Right. Okay. Right. Okay.
Michael Bell is the chair of the grounds committee at the farmstead. He's doing a demonstration for a dozen people about how to tap the ground's many mature sugar maple trees.
That's what we need right there.
Bell is trying to be reasonably authentic with how they would have collected sap back in 1886 when the property was first settled. The old-fashioned tap is 7/16 diameter with a hook from which the galvanized bucket and its lid will hang. During freezing temperatures, the tree draws in water from its roots. When the temperatures warm up, it expels sap. The freeze-thaw cycle will produce syrup-worthy sap until the tree grows buds. On days when these trees are really flowing, the four-gallon buckets will be completely full.
I was just reading something the other day, as the old-timers called it, 100 drips a minute. Sort of like a, you know, like a heartbeat rate, where just kind of at that pace.
And what we're looking at when we're tapping a tree is we want to start out with a minimum of 10 inches in diameter. If you go below that size, the tree isn't mature enough to be able to kind of handle that that damage from year to year. And when the tree gets above about 16 inches in diameter, you can tap it up to two times. The bigger the tree, the more deeply furrowed the branches are, so it can be a little harder to find a spot that's going to give you access to the, you know, the newest layer of cambium, which is where the sap is flowing.
You want to drill 6 to 10 inches away from any old tap sites because the sap flow won't be as great near the spots where the tree is healing.
So, it looks like we've got a good spot right here that's open that would make sure the bucket would hang from. So I'll go ahead and get the drill out and give this guy a shot right here. So just fit it into the hole and start giving it a whack. And you'll notice a distinct change in tone when it's seated. Right there, it just kind of gets sort of a dead sound. So you know you've got it all the way in. And then from there, just find the hole in the bucket and get that hook over that, drop it in there. And it's ready to go.
Photos of Michael Bell tapping maple trees at eartheats.org. From this point, it's a pretty long and involved process of boiling the sap down to syrup. But Michael Farrell says, hang on, tasting the sap as it drips straight from the tree is one of his favorite parts of the whole process.
Maple sap is a delicious beverage. It's all natural. It's, you know, what's bringing the tree to life in the springtime. And just like it's good for the trees, it's good for us.
Beverage companies are starting to realize sap is good to sell, too. Perhaps you've seen it at specialty stores. Farrell got hooked on maple syrup at a pancake breakfast in grad school when he was studying environmental science and forestry. With his book, The Sugar Maker's Companion, he hopes to transform some maple syrup lovers into maple syrup makers. Here's 1 minute with Michael Farrell.
I had the maple syrup at that pancake breakfast, and instantly I knew I wanted to try making it myself. Screwed up a lot. It's hard to do it right. And eventually got it right. But in the meantime, I decided to just drink a lot of sap because I also discovered how delicious the sap was. And that's what I really loved every spring was tapping the trees and collecting and drinking the sap. I do think we should get back to the point, as we did back in the 1800s, where most people tapped their trees to collect sap and to make sugar in the springtime. We produced a far greater amount of maple sugar back in the 1800s than we do today. Yet today we have a lot more maple trees. The technology has made the process much easier than it used to be. And there's no reason why we can't produce and consume just as much maple sugar as we did back when people were really living off the land. Okay.
Yeah, have a good one.
Thanks very much, Jimmy.
My pleasure. Bye. Good stuff from author Michael Farrell. His book is called The Sugar Maker's Companion. More at eartheats.org. Farmers don't make money planting or harvesting crops. They make money selling them. But marketing, managing those sales for the best profit, can be intimidating. As Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, that has farmers checking out an online game that can get them up to speed.
On a frigid day this winter, Chad Hart tries to warm his economics students at Iowa State University to the idea of managing some of the risk of farming using the commodity markets.
When I hit that level, guess what? I get what's called a margin call. They need to see I've got more money.
In class, Hart introduces tools farmers can use when selling their corn or soybeans. The students also play a web game called Commodity Challenge.
It's all about maximizing profit with risk management.
Robbie Maz is one of Hart's students. He returned to his family's Iowa farm 3 years ago.
But I got a understand it more before I can present it to a couple farmers who have been successful for over 20 years.
My name is Leah Moss. I'm Robbie's mother.
And she and her husband are Robbie's tough audience. The Commodity Challenge is like fantasy football, but for crop sales. In fantasy football, you put together your fake NFL team, and then the real-life games tell you how your team did. In the Commodity Challenge, you've got fake bushels of grain. You line up a marketing strategy, watch the real markets, and then see what profit or loss your decisions earned you.
As you see today, beans are down.
In the farmhouse kitchen, Robbie shows his mom the game. Leah Moss is skeptical. She looks at her son's Mac laptop as he clicks on links in the game.
You guys have experienced margin calls in this yet? That's where we got real familiar with that term when we were using marketers.
We studied it for a day, but...
margin calls, hedging, put options, these are unfamiliar terms for most people, farmers or not. But used wisely, these tools can set a farmer apart. They can insulate against the lowest prices and remove some of the uncertainty in cash flow. By planning ahead, farmers no longer rely on the spot price for corn or soybeans on the day they decide they need cash. It's a more methodical process than Leah Moss currently uses. She says she talks to neighbors and the local elevator manager and takes in the market shows on radio and TV.
This game is structured, and it makes you think about what you're doing. And we've pretty much not been very structured, I hate to admit, over the years.
Farm groups operate commodity games like this one across the country because risk management is so important for farmers. With the ability to store more grain on farm and with internet access to market data, savvy farmers can be well poised to make better use of marketing tools. When they have marketing plans, farmers are less likely to make the risky decision to wait for a better price, or to be stuck selling at a low price because they're short on cash. Ed Kordick with the Iowa Farm Bureau says with today's lower corn prices, he expects to see more interest in marketing.
When profits are very good, people want to lock them in. Or when profits are narrow, like I think this is the time period we're entering, people see that risk as something that they have to manage.
Robbie Moss is steeped in the details now, because unlike all those fantasy football coaches, Robbie's game is soon going to influence his reality. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration focused on issues of food, fuel, and field. More stories like this one at harvestpublicmedia.org and our website for interviews, news stories, and recipes is eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Michael Bell, Ayabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Michael Farrell, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Daniel Tucker, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. At the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Bloomington Hypnosis, with certified hypnotist and self-hypnosis instructor John Hunkler, helping clients relax into weight loss for health and fitness. Bloomington Hypnosis, 812-200-5005. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. This is Earth Eats. Thanks for being here today. I'm Annie Corrigan.